Talk given Saturday, 10th of March, 1979. The Buddha declared that the purpose of the holy life was to realize unconditioned freedom of mind. That is the culmination, he said. That is the pith in connection with the living of the holy life. We all imagine that we more or less understand what is meant by unconditioned freedom of mind. Now, it is particularly in connection with this word mind that I think it would be helpful to consider some points. When we use the word mind, we confine the meaning of that word to our psychical processes, our thoughts, our feelings, our ideas, what we call our perceptions, our visions, our little sparks of inspiration or moments of enlightenment. But we little realize that whilst there is a shadow of truth in all this, we are on the whole deceiving ourselves that we understand what is meant by the word mind when used by any of the perfected holy ones, the enlightened ones, the liberated ones. Unconditional freedom of mind. The Buddha, as far as I'm aware, well, please correct me if I'm wrong, didn't use the word psyche. Is there a Pali word which corresponds to the word psyche? It's always mind, isn't it? And in Mahayana too, it's always the word mind. So now, we associate the word mind with our psychical processes, our psychical functioning, which means essentially the functioning of our physical senses together with their associated consciousnesses, sight consciousness, hearing consciousness, touch consciousness, and so forth, the functioning of the senses plus the synthesizing, I'm using the word in a rather more mechanical sense than an organic sense, and the synthesizing of by the brain of all the impressions that we receive. Now let's be quite clear about that. We confine the word mind to our psychical activity, the thoughts, feelings, etc., and the activity of the brain in synthesizing the impressions that we receive. Now, to what context do these belong? They all belong to the context of the finite, the measurable, the mortal. They begin, they proceed, they end, birth, death, and to the context of the ever-changing. This is essentially what we associate with which we associate the word mind. Now, this psychophysical life of ours, of the living person who is born, lives and dies, this is the entire process was declared by the Buddha to be dukkha, suffering, far from the infinite, to go into its root meaning, other than the transcendent. And the Buddha made no bones about affirming, positively, unequivocally affirming the absolute, the transcendent. You all know that. If there were not that transcendent, the unborn, unbecome, unmade, there would be no release out of this, the born, the becoming, the made, the perishing. Now, in what terms does that release take place or can take place? It takes place in terms of mind in its own rights, at its own, in its own plane of being. And we have spent several years at our group meetings trying in our limited little way to understand what is implied in the use of the word mind. And you may remember I have often said that whilst this is my own arbitrary presentation, but I have found it very convenient, I have suggested that mind be regarded as that archetypal, universal mode of expression of primordial creative energy which releases cosmos, the entire becoming process, out of chaos, chaos used in its original meaning of vibrant quiescence, non-manifested. Now, if you regard mind in this way, we will see that it is completely out of our experience in terms of our senses and in terms of any of our brain activity or intellectual processes, etc. In other words, the context of mind is not the finite, the measurable, the mortal, and the ever-changing. The true context of mind is the context of transcendence itself, the context of religion in its profoundest meaning. It is the context to which the words eternity, immortality, infinity apply. Have we ever had a real touch of infinity, of eternity, of immortality, realizing itself through our finite processes of thought, feeling, which come into being, pass away? How do we define eternity? As the opposite of time. It isn't the opposite of time. That is a very inadequate and misleading way of regarding eternity. When we say, oh yes, it is the same as timelessness. When time stands still and you are in that deep state of meditation, one of the deepest states of meditation in which the totality is there. Words, but they are not yet anywhere near the reality of eternity. Even less misleading would it be to understand it this way, that eternity is not the opposite of time or what we call the timeless. Because all our experience of the timeless is bounded by time limits. Our experience of timelessness starts, proceeds, also comes to an end. See, we have to bear this very clearly in mind. It's the same with infinity. We have no option but to say it is the opposite of the finite. But that too is a misleading definition. It is the non-finite, true enough. But like eternity, like immortality, these completely subsume the finite, the mortal, the ever-changing, and so forth. When consciousness comes to be at home quite naturally and spontaneously in terms of dimensions or a dimension, if even, of being, of mind and consciousness itself, which transcends all our dimensions, then the ephemeral dimensions are all part and parcel. They are subsumed, taken up by that which is transcendent. You may all remember I have suggested that one way of seeing it is just this. We know a point has no dimensions. If a point moves, which is a living activity, if you can't with a succession of points, however close, produce a line, that point moves, which is a great mystery, movement, then there is a line. The movement of the line produces a surface. The movement of a surface produces your solid object. Now, our ordinary consciousness as physical organisms is capable of being conscious in terms of three dimensions of space. If we were not capable of being conscious of three dimensions of space, surfaces would have no meaning. If we had only a two-dimensional consciousness of space, a line would have no meaning at all. Because with just two dimensions, we would say, put so many lines side by side, you'll get a surface, you won't. So you see the meaning of subsume. It's very important to understand this. It's taken up into the profounder dimension as such. Now the Buddha definitely declared unconditional freedom of mind. He did not declare unconditional freedom of sense functioning and brain activity. Now, since mind is this archetypal mode of expression of primordial creative energy, whatever that is, which releases the whole cosmos into being as such, mind itself transcends all the dimensions of the cosmos as we experience the cosmos. In other words, this statement by the Buddha is one of the profoundest religious statements ever made, because we went into this last year. The word religion derived from re ligare or re legere by Cicero, re ligare by Servius, Lactantius, and St. Augustine and such people, you see. We went into that. And they mean essentially to gather together, re legere, or to bind back. In other words, they both mean precisely what the word yoga means, from yuj. You see? Now, this binding back, to use the word bind, is a little bit unfortunate. You don't bind it. You release the two-dimensional into the three-dimensional, the three-dimensional into the transcendent dimensions. You release it there. When the Buddha teaches, and his teaching is translated as escaping from dukkha, escaping from this constriction in which we live, escape is a very bad word. It is released into the other, because you grew into that. You see, that is a completely different thing from running away from this. Escape has no meaning apart from running away. So, unconditional freedom of mind. And he uses the word unconditional. By contrast with the whole cosmos, which we experience in the manner that we do experience it whilst we are unenlightened, the whole cosmos, our mode of experiencing it, is the conditioned mode. It's the paticca-samuppada business, the dependence. This is here because this is here. If this and this were not here, this particular thing wouldn't be here. And that applies to each and everything. So you see, not only do we begin to see light, what is meant by conditionality and conditioned existence, but we also begin to see a profounder significance in declaring that death is, I'll use the Western terminology, the last enemy to be conquered. A most unfortunate way of expressing it, but that is it. Why this curious relationship to the word death, and this attitude to the word death? You see, deep down in our psyche, and the brain very rarely ever comes to know it, is the dread that this conditionality, this bondage, and all the suffering associated with this bondage is going to be forever and ever in unending time after I am dead. You see? How do we, in the ordinary way, then, try to grapple with this problem of death? Death, the terrible thing. How are we going to tackle it? Oh, we seek ways and means, different techniques, different studies, different modes of living, purely as taught by the holy ones, where the moralities are concerned and all the rest of it, in order that we may barter our virtue, our our righteous living for not being subjected to this terrible conditionality and bondage after death. We will never get it that way. There will be no we, no I, no you, in the ordinary sense of the words you or I, which continues to be after the complete disintegration. This is what death of the organism means. After the complete disintegration of these ephemeral, ever-changing elements which constitute, manifest as, the particular individual. So you see, all our psychical activity, our visions as we call them, our aspirations and hopes and whatnot, all of them are tied up in this terrible net of falsity. And we always imagine that we have had a true perception of how we should live, what we should do, in order that the supreme fulfillment for me, the individual, as well as for mankind as a whole, that is always only secondary to me, the individual, may take place. You see how we are caught in this terrific darkness of delusion, which completely imprisons the whole of the psyche and the functioning of the brain which is supposed to know. Now, unconditional freedom of mind. And we have, during the last 3 months, the last three meetings, December, January, February, considered in some sort of depth what depth we are capable of considering. We have considered this business about the meaning of perceptions as presented in Mahayana. And the most perplexing statements linguistically in which that teaching has been conveyed. Because, O Subhuti, perceptions are, the Buddha has taught that perceptions are no perceptions. That is why they are called perceptions. Called. And that's the key word. They are named as perceptions. It's a false name. Parading under false pretenses. You see? There was no option but to use that sort of language. Because do remember, the Mahayana teachings came into beings, were put into writing centuries after the death of the Buddha. And we tried to see that they are called perceptions for the very simple reason that no language in the world has words for that which transcends all finite experiences and finite naming in terms of the sense consciousnesses and the activity of the brain. That is why it is presented in that way. But now, recall the very first statement with which we started today. The culmination, the pith of the holy life is unconditional freedom of mind. And in that wonderful discourse, the lesser discourse on the pith, it comes in the first volume of the Majjhima, the Buddha talks about the deeper states of consciousness into which one enters in meditation, till at last one reaches the supreme state of meditation. There are two discourses. One is called the longer discourse and the other is called the shorter discourse. And in one discourse, the end comes with these rather perplexing words that you can fall back from this. In the other discourse, dealing with the same thing, where the whole thing is repeated, and then he proceeds with something more excellent than having arrived at this stage. And he repeats the entry into the various jhanas and the four samapatis. Translate samapatis as coalescences. That is far better than the very restricted Pali translation from the Pali of attainments. They are not attainments. Coalescences is the right word. What happens when you are in that state of the fourth jhana? There is still sensory perception taking place, but you are not affected by it. You are not bound by it, for the very simple reason that in the living of the holy life, in the true discipline, the learning process of living religiously, we have learned not to grasp at any of the impressions, thoughts, ideas, sublime and exalted states of the psyche which come into being. You see, we don't grasp them, we let them flow past. And with the going down, that is the actual term used in the text, with the going down of all sensory impressions, with the state of complete mindfulness and equanimity, that is perfect balance, this quiescent state, which is the fully active and the fully alive state, not a static state, being present, it is said that the bhikkhu, the meditator, enters into and abides in the plane of infinite akasha. Infinite akasha. And the next is infinite vijnana. This is cosmos consciousness together, these two, cosmos and consciousness. But the real emphasis has to come upon the word infinite. This is the dimension of being and consciousness, or both these, if you like, are the dimensions of being and consciousness, which completely subsume the ever-changing, the mortal, the finite, the conditioned. So this is the first entry, and this is a death in terms of your own awareness, your own consciousness. Now what has happened is this. There is no longer any interference by one's own individual psychical processes or brain activity. No interference preventing this universal energy mind from flowing freely through you. And it is transcendence itself, the total universe, which is coming to self-realization of itself as a totality through you, the finite. This is the first movement into freedom. Now, nothing conditional affects you in that state of being. Nothing conditioned affects you. And then the other two stages enters upon and abides on the plane of no thing. The complete release from every conditioned state. And then it says the plane of neither perception nor non-perception. Now relate this to the Mahayana teaching. When this kind of actual experiencing of the spaceless and the timeless, of the infinite is taking place, when it is actually taking place, there is this realization, when you come back to ordinary consciousness, that there was a true perception. But you cannot utilize that true perception, because that perception has no particularity. It is no longer a subject perceiving an object. Therefore, there is no separation. The unity of the universe is absolute there. Absolute, realized through the relative, oneself. And it is the relative that contains the dualities and multiplicities, contains the opposites and their conflict. And this is the dukkha. You have released yourself as the obstructing, separating organism which stands in the way of the eternal life, of the eternal light. You have released yourself out of that obstructive state, and transcendence functions through you, the light of the eternal. And this is the enlightened mind manifesting itself through John Brown or Siddhartha Gautama or whoever it is. So, in that state, there is neither perception nor non-perception. You can see that the meaning of the word perception in that context has no relationship to our ordinary everyday meaning of perception. You see, Mahayana contains all this also. The jhanas and the samapatis and the final liberated state in the cessation, as it is called. So, this is the dimension of being and consciousness, which is the state of unconditioned freedom of mind. It's very, very important to understand this. We can understand it with our own intellectual abilities, however short they fall from the intellect of a Buddha. But we can begin to get a glimmer. And our glimmer is most helpful this way, that it tells us what mind is, how mind is not to be understood, not to be defined. It tells us how to recognize, to recognize all our faultiness of perception and definition, and so forth. And the consequent activity in our everyday life which comes out of this faulty perception of truth. And also of non-perception. Now you see, why non-perception? Why is non-perception added on? In the realm of the infinite, of the eternal, of the immortal, what meaning can the word perception have? It just doesn't apply in our sense of the word. To us, it is like a non-perception. If let us use the word God because it is a small word and very convenient to use the word. Does God, who is declared to be the absolute all, know himself? He doesn't know himself. It's impossible. Supposing you were the only thing existing in the infinitude of space, of eternity. Supposing you were the only thing existing, could you possibly know anything at all, including yourself? You can't. You know by virtue of otherness, by virtue of separation, by virtue of constriction, by virtue of conditionality. That's how you know. But this thing can be experienced because it is the liberation into this transcendent state which subsumes the whole of the what we might somewhat justifiably call the not transcendent. I say somewhat justifiably, very grudgingly, for the very simple reason that just as surface, line, point, they are all subsumed within the three-dimensional object. All this which is dukkha is subsumed within transcendence itself. There is nothing left out. If it were not, there would be no possibility of release out of the bondage imposed upon us by conditionality into the unconditioned state. Now, we have tried to understand these during these months the sort of cool aspect of such realization, which is the wisdom aspect. Wisdom is the cool aspect. There is the warm aspect. Mahaprajna, the great, the transcendent insight into the truth of things, complemented by Mahakaruna, the transcendent compassion. Now, where can the transcendent compassion emerge? How can it emerge? What do we mean by compassion? Don't just tie yourself down to dictionary meanings. They are all right in their extremely limited sense. But we associate compassion with pity, with affection, with all, in all sorts of ways we talk about compassion. But if you look at each and every one of those ways, you will see that they imply conditionality, separation, and therefore sorrow, conflict, trouble, difficulty. we rush about doing good to this person, that person, out of compassion. Yes, the urge is right. The ultimate source of that urge is the transcendent, unquestionably. But what have I, the servant of the Supreme, done with it when that urge arose out of the transcendent? The Lord delegated a small task to me, and I went and made the usual muddle. You see, therefore, why the yogi, the monk, the bhikkhu, the devotee, the supreme ones I'm talking of, why they spend their time in constant meditation, in constant prayer. Perhaps we begin to see the meanings. In bringing about the non-obstructiveness of ourselves upon the forces of transcendence as they work throughout the totality, in bringing that about, when we ourselves, the finite obstructor, in those rare moments, reach that condition where eternity, immortality, infinity can manifest themselves through us, then there arises within us an extraordinary sensitivity. Not another sensitivity, it's one and the same sensitivity. It functions as wisdom, truth, goodness, beauty, and so on. This sensitivity is compassion, is karuna, is love. The theistic religions have called it the love of God. Not I loving God, but God's love for the totality, functioning through me as the individual. That sensitivity begins now, which was lying dormant, to thrill. I think it's in somewhere in amongst the last pages of the Heart of Religion. It is really from the plane of infinite akasha and infinite vijnana that true karuna, metta, can flow out. You see? It is not I, therefore, who am compassionate or friendly or in sympathy with the joys and sorrows of others. It's not I who am doing it. It is this transcendent reality, mind itself, God himself, if you like, the Atma itself, use any word you like, you see, which is now active in the universal world process, the cosmic process. Neither you nor I can ever know how it works in our terms of the word knowing. But it is there, and it functions. And that is the indispensable complement to transcendent wisdom. When those two, which are only the cool and the warm aspects of the same reality, are in the state of permanent harmony, permanent fruition, then what is called the unconditional freedom of mind is realized. And when that is realized, then no more is there the arising of the asavas. The asavas have been called the cankers. Well, it has a place to use that word canker. But for myself, I prefer the original commoner garden meaning of asava. It's an overflow, an exudation. If you slash a tree, you'll get an exudation, that the wounded tree exudes fluid, like the body would exude blood if it is wounded, and so forth. An overflow. The overflows of consciousness into what? Into all the states of bondage, of conditionality. Desire, passion, greed, tanha, of wanting to become this, that, and the other, of producing all sorts of theories and whatnot, because we are such clever people, geniuses, you see, with tainted, imperfect psyches, which always are producing utopias and so forth. All that exudation, that wounded state, as far as one's own consciousness is concerned, has ended. So there is the complete ending of all ill. And I trust we have begun to see something of the real meaning of mind and the meaning of the unconditioned freedom of mind. It is this state which is the completely human state, the happy creator. Now indeed, creation proceeds through you, the finite individual.